Today on Against the Grain, she raised her voice. She refused to be silenced. She was expelled from the U.S. for opposing the criminalization of dissent and so much more. The anarchist and agitator Emma Goldman has fascinated and inspired Candace Falk for four decades. I'm C.S., the director of the Emma Goldman Papers Project, joins me, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Emma Goldman was so many things: anarchist, feminist, agitator for free speech and free love, workers' rights advocate, birth control crusader, anti-war activist, renowned orator. She was also, in the eyes of the U.S. government, a dangerous figure, a formidable threat, someone who could foment chaos and insubordination and even revolution. So Emma Goldman was targeted, she was pursued, and after being jailed for 18 months beginning in 1917, she was deported. What did she do that so inflamed the authorities, including the young J. Edgar Hoover? What drove her to speak out and to put her freedom and her life at risk? And what happened to Goldman and the focus of her criticism after the U.S. entered World War I? As the director of the Emma Goldman Papers Project, Candace Falk has edited a series of, so far, three volumes called Emma Goldman, A Documentary History of the American Years. Volume 4, which is forthcoming, has the title Democracy Disarmed, 1917-1919. It examines the 2 years leading up to Goldman's deportation from the U.S. Emma Goldman was born in 1869 in what is now Lithuania. When Candace Falk joined me in studio, I asked her about Emma Goldman's life before she moved to the U.S.
Goldman was part of a Jewish circle of people in Europe and in Russia who experienced quite a bit of prejudice. However, she herself was kind of a rabble-rouser. And so when she was in school, teachers would get upset with her when she wanted to do things that were a little bit wilder than her father thought was appropriate. He would be actually physically punitive to her. She saw many things in her life, including Russians being thrust into the military, and she saw her mother actually try to dissuade the government people right on the spot from doing it. So it's not like she didn't come from a rabble-rousing family. However, in the context of her life and sadness, the things that made her able to function better had to do with beauty, the beauty of music and opera. And also, it was this early revolutionary time, and reading the novels of, say, Chernyshevsky, who wrote a novel called What Is to Be Done? And it was really about communal living and people who shared ideals and a vision and their economic livelihoods. And that was the vision that she longed for. But she left Russia for more personal reasons, which is that young girls of her age, she left when she was 15 or 16, were forced to marry somebody. Like, arranged marriages were the thing. So she, like many other people, it was a combination of anti-Semitism and arranged marriages that got her on the boat to go to the United States. And interestingly enough, in her autobiography, she describes the amazing excitement of seeing the Statue of Liberty in the distance. And the Statue of Liberty actually wasn't up yet. It wasn't erected yet. It was going to happen in the next few years. So it just shows in her mind that was where she was going.
And she ends up in, initially, in Rochester, New York. So what does she observe or hear about in the U.S. that further radicalizes her?
It was not long after that that the Haymarket anarchists were hung. And this was a horrifying thing to many people. And I don't think she really knew much about it until she heard a woman speaking about what seemed like a setup of blaming bombings and the death of several people
at a
demonstration in Chicago. It was an easy target to blame it on the anarchists. And she says directly that one of the people, when he was being hung, said that our voices will carry on louder, even though they're silenced now. And I think Emma really thought that she was one of the voices to carry on. She also made personal relationships with this German and Jewish community of people who were already radicalized. And that was quite exciting. She learned so much. And she didn't actually speak English. And they all spoke German and Yiddish, kind of. And what's remarkable is eventually she became this incredibly eloquent speaker.
And what kind of work did she get in Rochester and in other places she lived on in the East Coast? And what did that indicate to her about the treatment of workers in the U.S.?
She worked first in a factory, a garment factory. And she worked many long hours and did not get very much money. And the story that she tells in her autobiography is that at one point she came to her boss and said, "I don't have money to even buy a flower." And he responded, "Your tastes are too elaborate or too elevated for a working class woman like you." So she was horrified.
She ended up on the Lower East Side of New York City. What happened? Like, what was her break, if there was? Who discovered her, or who decided that she should be the one to get up on stage and talk to people about justice and equality and liberty?
She was really discovered by Johann Most. And Johann Most was this very, very powerful German speaker. At that time, he identified more with anarchism, socialism. And he saw in Emma a person who could really tell a story and reach an audience. And in many ways, he shepherded her. And what happened to her, though, was she didn't really, after a while, want to say exactly what he said for her to say. And so, what can I say? Challenge authority, you know? She began to speak on her own and extend her work on the 8-hour day, for example, which was what he was really anxious for her to do, to talk about how workers actually should have much more control over their workplace, that it's not just a situation where the boss gives you fewer hours to work. I mean, that was one of many things. But she got a very fine response. And in 1890, there was an article in a newspaper about Emma speaking that called her an eloquent woman.
1890, so that means she was about 21. She was born in 1869. We are going to talk about her feelings about the war, World War I, when it came, and conscription, the draft. But what were the other causes, so maybe some of the early causes, in addition to workers' rights, that she threw herself behind?
Emma Goldman believed that anarchism covered everything. That anarchism essentially was a code word for freedom. There's a trajectory. So even though most people thought, violence against government, well, it's true that she thought the government at the time and the authorities were not really serving the people's needs and were linked up to big business, you know, factory owners and such. But every aspect of that level of giving up your freedom touched Emma. So early on, she talked about women's freedom not to marry. That was really not done very well. And if you weren't married, you were really almost like a pariah. And also that you didn't need the state to tell you whether or not you could be married. That was really against the church and the state to not need to have their approval. She also did not believe in straightforward heterosexual relationships because she was in contact with and in tune with the variety of sexual preferences and identities. And so in her talk, she would talk about homosexuality. She even had a talk that she gave that was called the intermediate sex because it didn't have a name at that time. That horrified the status quo people. She also didn't believe in traditional schooling. She really felt like that part of her job was to educate people, but to educate people was truly to allow them and guide them into making their own decisions. So that, you know, bumper sticker that says question authority, she would encourage people to question her authority. She believed that everything should be a choice. On the other hand, she was not somebody who didn't think that you needed to take care of other people economically. The class differences were painful. And at that time, you know, people starving in the street. And so she believed, you know, sometimes she called herself, not often, but what she really was an anarchist communist, because that idea of making sure that everybody had money was very important to her. One of the very interesting things I think is that people often ask me, like, well, what did Emma Goldman say? What are we supposed to do? And one of the things that's interesting about her is that she didn't have a roadmap. She felt like you had to, in a way, you had to instill people with the idea of freedom, the idea that you could do something and then move from there.
That's Candace Falk. She is the editor and director of the Emma Goldman Papers Project, and she is editor of a series called Emma Goldman, A Documentary History of the American Years. Volume 4 is forthcoming. It will be entitled Democracy Disarmed, 1917 to 1919, and we'll talk about that volume coming up. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. What was the Comstock Law? This was passed in 1873, and how did Emma Goldman feel about it?
The Comstock Law was a law that made almost everything that was overtly sexual censored from the mail, illegal to give out. Birth control information was the perfect example of what the Comstock Law was against. So whereas it started out to be something about like lewdness, almost like what they would call pornography, just giving out information about how to prevent having a child, how to prevent conception, that in itself was outlawed. And then besides that, if you handed out that information, you were also sent to jail, which is what Emma was sent to jail too. And she continued to speak on many issues like that. One of the first issues of her magazine called Mother Earth had an essay called White Slave Traffic. White slave traffic at that time was the code for prostitution. That issue that talked about how the prostitute should not be victimized by the law to do something that she needed to do or even wanted to do. that was banned from the mail, and it took a while for them to get it back in circulation.
What did Emma Goldman think of electoral politics as an avenue for social and political change?
She saw that voting often didn't change the whole structure and often fed into, in fact, a structure of domination of business, literally. And she was very close to many of the socialists who believed that you could change the world through gradually. She was close to them, but she didn't agree with them. And I think that was one of the things that scared a lot of people about Emma Goldman. Like, what do you mean no government? What do you mean you're not going to vote? And I think in a time when the suffrage movement was really active, a lot of the women really didn't like her, felt like she was not good. And then there were other people who just thought, you're telling it like it is.
So in 1914, World War I begins, and the U.S. is not in the war for several years. And then Woodrow Wilson, who was elected on the promise not to enter the war, he required all men between the ages of 21 and 30 to register for the draft on June 5th, 1917. What position did Goldman take on the draft?
The draft, as you can imagine, had no choice to it. The draft was, you have to do this. And that's the last thing that Emma thought anybody should do. And what was interesting is that she spoke originally saying, I'm not against you choosing it, although she actually was. But her real issue was to have a choice, and that young men all over the country actually were about to sacrifice their lives for something that they did not choose. There were many no conscription leagues, and the people in those no conscription leagues were eventually arrested. There were other people who helped, like Roger Baldwin, who helped the people who evaded the draft, gave them legal advice and services. But that was her main point in the beginning about conscription. And in fact, in 1915, she spoke out. She was speaking out everywhere, saying, you have to speak out against war before the bloodshed happens.
So Emma Goldman opposed war. On behalf of which interest did she feel like, did she believe, did she argue war was waged?
She believed that the war was waged for big business. And in fact, the United States weapons industry supported much of the war, and it was a booming industry. And she felt like the people were being duped into feeling that this was a war for democracy. That's what Woodrow Wilson eventually said, that you had to save the world for democracy. And during that time, how do you change a whole population that didn't want to go to war to decide to go to war and risk their life? And it turned out that there was a Committee for Public Information that Woodrow Wilson started, which was literally the beginning of advertising in the United States, where people, and many of them quite liberal, were tasked with convincing the people that this was worth their lives. And so newspapers, posters, the 4-minute men who would come to a movie theater and talk to people, shaming men into doing this, getting as many of the women involved to feel like they're helping the war effort. And, you know, we all know that people love to feel united in some way. Sadly, this was the way.
Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman, her longtime comrade, were arrested and jailed in July 1917. They gave a talk, I believe, in May of that year. They were charged with conspiring to oppose conscription, which was required by this Selective Service Act of 1917. So they go to trial, and they could, of course, you know, they have a right to an attorney. What do they do, and what kind of arguments are presented on their behalf?
Emma thought, and rightly so, that this was her opportunity to speak her mind, to say a complete sentences and not be dragged away, to express what they had always wanted to say, not only about anarchism, but about freedom and about equality and about war and the reasons for war, and also deportations, which she knew was coming down the pike by that time. So she and Alexander Berkman chose to defend themselves. And the other side, the government side, was completely flawed by how persuasive she was. And in their final concluding arguments, they said, she may be very persuasive and elegant, but our argument is elegant. And their argument was, don't pay attention to what she's saying, because in fact, and they were right, she was standing in the way. She was obstructing selected services, even though she said, and I believe, that she didn't make anybody not go. But her argument, it was very much an argument about free speech and free speech in America. And I think that that was one of the most important trials, along with some trials that came after that, to articulate the importance of being able to speak against something. So she was talking about how awful it was to criminalize dissent and how dissent should be a right.
And there were laws passed which criminalized dissent, which clamped down on free speech, especially during the war, right? During World War I?
Sedition and espionage laws. Actually, the people who were arrested for sedition and espionage came after, and some of the government surveillance people said to her, you're lucky you only got 2 years in jail. Other people who wrote letters to soldiers like Louise Olivero or Eugene Debs, they all got really long sentences, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, including these two young boys at the age of 17 who gave out leaflets at a talk in Madison Square Garden for Emma's upcoming lecture, May 18th, and they too got arrested, and she felt terrible about that.
So part of, as I understand it, the prosecutor's strategy was to paint her as an anarchist and to paint really anyone who testified on her behalf as an anarchist and to make that association between anarchism and violence, right? Anarchists are bomb throwers, and they are not just troublemakers, but they commit violence. So how did Emma Goldman try and counter that? And also, what did she think about the relationship or the role of violence in anarchist activism?
Well, as I mentioned before, her opinion of what anarchism was so different from what the jurors thought. And she really resented anarchism being associated only with violence and these sort of bomb-throwing destructionists. And as I said, it felt like it was really about freedom. She has one thing where she says, I want freedom, the right to self-expression, everybody's right to beautiful, radiant things. That's hardly bomb-throwing. However, I have to say that there's a trajectory between the most violent and the most pacifist. And many of the people who you read about or know about come in between those that trajectory. And she came out of Russia, and she came out of Europe, where a lot of assassinations actually seemed to make a difference. And so that got carried over to some of the people who came here. And many of them actually came to Emma. They trusted Emma, and they talked about their plans. And she often dissuaded them from, she said, you know, the Americans aren't really, that's just going to backfire. On the other hand, sometimes when something happened that was quite violent, she took it as an opportunity to express what that person meant. So what she was a translator for that kind of activity. And I think she would never betray anybody who did a act of violence, but she wouldn't do it herself. And so, of course, she was associated with violence, and she wouldn't overtly negate it, you know, say, I hate this. But we have her letters in which she says, she writes back and forth during the 1914 bombing that happened in a townhouse in New York where people were getting ready to make a bomb to bring to Rockefeller, you know, in response to the horrible tent killings of so many people at the time. And she felt like when she found out that there were innocent people killed along the way, she was very, very upset.
Candace Falk is her name. She joins me in studio. She is the editor and director of the Emma Goldman Papers Project in Berkeley. We'll take a short break and speak more with Candace about Emma Goldman, one of the most important and influential dissenters in U.S. history. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Candace Falk joins me. She is the founding director of the Emma Goldman Papers Project. It's a kind of an archive and, of course, a research project. It's produced three volumes of Emma Goldman's documents, heavily annotated. So there's a lot of commentary and explanation that goes along with the documents. I have here in my hand the titles of the first three volumes of Emma Goldman, A Documentary History of the American Years. Volume one was called Made for America, 1890 to 1901. Volume two was called Making Speech Free, 1902 to 1909. And volume three is Light and Shadows, 1910 to 1916. And forthcoming is the fourth and final volume of the series. It will be called Democracy Disarmed, 1917 to 1919, 1919 being the year that Emma Goldman was put on a boat involuntarily for the USSR. She was deported by J. Edgar Hoover and his allies. So there's this essay, which will be included in this volume four. It's called Deportation, Its Meaning and Menace. And she makes a number of interesting and important claims in this essay that I'd like to ask you about. First of all, so obviously there was a lot of anti-German sentiment during World War I. And then she noticed, as did many other people, that sentiment, that hatred and hostility and suspicion had moved, had been redirected toward another population as the war ended. Who was that population and how were they treated?
The population was that received the detritus of the hatred were Russian radical Jews, mostly. Part of the reason was that it's very easy to have a scapegoat when everything didn't turn out that way. Everybody wasn't in a euphoric state when the war was over. It was a very sad time, all the deaths and everything. And at the same time, Russia had a revolution. And in 1917, it was really building up. And Emma, who had always dreamed of something like what the vision of the revolution was going to happen, she was thrilled. And she spoke about it, and, you know, this kept her going. And so she not only spoke against conscription and the war and free speech, she also spoke quite a bit about Bolshevism. And that was terrifying to the U.S. government because it actually did look like something could happen in the United States. And so also the U.S. Army, you know, was recycled into fighting in white Russia, you know, against. And Goldman was horrified by it, but there were so many people who were pulled from their houses. It was like this arrests beyond belief because it was, quote unquote, in the interest of national security. But Russian radicals, mostly Jewish, were taken from their houses, put into kind of jails, left by themselves, not given any time to even catch their breath before they were deported. It was the beginning of the mass deportations.
In this essay, Deportation, Its Meaning and Menace, and maybe in some of her other writings, did Edma Goldman blame President Woodrow Wilson for the war?
She did and she didn't. You know, she thought Wilson looked like a better guy than he was. He was, after all, he was this college professor and he had a vision like the League of Nations. He had so many things that he spoke of that were actually, you know, she could get behind. On the other hand, she thought he was a dupe to industry. And there were many people who had, you know, a lock on his will and pushed him in different ways. And I, you know, one never. And he himself started to get behind a lot of the deportations, you know. Although he was quite sick when Emma was deported. So he, you know, there's a debate about whether he did it or not. But he was incredibly anti-anarchist and anti-radical at that time. But, you know, nobody stands alone. You can scapegoat the president, but if you don't know that there's something behind that.
The structural forces.
The structural forces, yeah.
What did, and I think this essay was written by both Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman, what did they argue had happened to workers' sense of empowerment during the war? You know, a war during which there were slogans like, labor will win the war.
I think they were incredibly excited. They had jobs. A lot of the people who were high union people switched sides and decided that they were for the war. And they won many, many battles, union battles. They had higher wages. You know, they felt more empowered. So Emma said, she said, it has given the toilers a sense of their power. It has made them arrogant, aye, menacing. No more are they satisfied with a fair day's wage for a fair day's work. No, not even with wages doubled and trebled. They are laying sacrilegious hands upon the most sacrosanct institution of private ownership. They challenge the exclusive mastery of the owner in his own mine and mill. They demand actual participation in industry, even in the most secret councils. They control production and manipulation of distribution. They even dare suggest taking over the labor of all industry. Labor is in rebellion against the state and capital, even against their own leaders that have so long held them in check. There were so many strikes during this period of history. It was incredible. And that was the other thing that frightened the government. And the strikes were most often suppressed violently. Was it the class war? I don't know, but it was a variation on that theme.
Candace Falk is her name. She is editor and director of the Emma Goldman Papers Project and author of Love, Anarchy, and Emma Goldman, a biography. So on the verge of deportation, one could forgive, or one could understand Emma Goldman being somewhat despairing and feeling like all was lost. She was going to lose her citizenship. They were going to strip her of her citizenship. That's what they did, annulled her citizenship. And to have a very negative attitude toward the prospect or the possibility of change in the direction she wanted, toward liberty. So was that, in fact, how she wrote and felt as she was about to depart, as she was about to be deported?
Interestingly, and probably quite a bit of the reason why people flock to her quotes even today, is that she was somebody who really had hope. Like one of her lectures in Detroit said, sooner or later, the American people are going to wake up. And she also actually wanted to be part of the Russian Revolution. So, however, she also took it as her role to make sure that other people didn't go into despair. She wanted people to do work to make it different, to not feel that this was the end, and to get across the idea that you really can't deport dissent. You just can't. And so they could deport everybody, and there would still be critical thinking and speaking about such things. You know, when she went to Russia, it was not what she hoped for. And that was crushing. Leaving America, being deported, had a little bit of that feeling of, I'm a heroine for the people. I'm doing this because I am fearless. You know, you tell me not to speak, I'm going to speak in your face, you know. And so she was happy not to compromise herself. And she was also a person who understood that a lot of people couldn't do what she did. So she was kind of an example for them. And that's why the government also thought they had caught the big fish. And that was an example. But when she went to Russia, it was very interesting because she had already had arguments with Breskovskaya, who was one of the great women Russian revolutionaries, who was really not happy with the way the revolution was going. And Emma was terrified that this was going to squash any hope for the revolution. And the letters we have say, you know, maybe you're right, but give them a chance. You know, they're young revolution. Everybody is trying to fight against them. Give them some time. And that was her position at that time. Of course, when she realized that the situation turned so brutal, and ironically, as a spokesperson for free speech in America, she thought, how could this be? Why isn't there free speech in Russia? And she had a great quote where she says, I am thinking of the future and the work I want to do for America much more than for Russia. Is it because I'm forced out of here that I long passionately to do much for this country? So her loyalty was here. And so when Emma was deported with 248 others in 1919 under the Immigration Act of 1918, you know, a hole was created in American history that couldn't be repaired.
What about Spanish anarchism and specifically the Spanish anarchist effort during the Spanish Civil War? What impact did that have on Emma Goldman?
When the Spanish anarchists were fighting their battle and most of them lived in communes and communal, she saw anarchism in action. And the people there, when she went three times, the people there, they consider her the mother of their revolution. I think what was interesting is that rather than being completely destroyed when Spain went the other way, shall we say, she got busy right away raising money and awareness about the Spanish women and children, refugees of the war, and spoke, instead of talking about why they lost, about how amazing it was that this was a moment in time where you could get a vision of what it must be like.
Candace Falk is editor and director of the Emma Goldman Papers Project. Tell us about the project and how long it's been around and what it does and the current state of it.
This is a complicated question because, believe it or not, I really did start the project in 1980. We were a project that was brought in. I was brought in because I was working on Love, Anarchy and Emma Goldman and had done lots of research on particular letters and papers. But the National Archives had a program for historians to collect and organize the papers of the founding fathers because they felt like you can't write history unless you have the actual documents. And so it wasn't until the 70s and a group before me, you know, stormed the National Archives and said, it's not only the great white men, there are other people. So they gave a list of people and included Martin Luther King, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, Margaret Sanger, and Emma Goldman. So they started it was called the National Historical Publications and Records Commission, started to ask people like me to apply to do that. I had no idea that it would take this long. I thought it would take 2 years because to a person on the outside, it just looks like you're just collecting paper and putting it together. So it took the first 15 years were just finding places all over the country and the world that had letters of Emma Goldman's and getting copies of them. Because the idea originally was to democratize access through creating a microfilm. Of course, the minute our microfilm came out, microfilm went out of style. But I have to say very proudly that the Internet Archive, so you can go to archive.org and have access, open access, to 22,000 documents that we had collected and organized for the microfilm edition. And what I feel really proud of is that, you know, maybe in our books we're interpretive, and although we give you the option of seeing material, but it's a selected edition. This edition, the online edition, is just everything we found and a guide to it. So that if you want to see what the surveillance people wrote, it's there. If you want to see some essays that she wrote that never got published. And so I feel very proud of that, but I think it took 15 years to do it, and it took almost 10 years to find a place that would digitize them, not charge us money, and not charge students and other people money to get in, you know, because a lot of these are subscriptions. So you have to be part of an institution. And I wanted every teenager to be able to go online and read anything. Love letter, political treaties, it's there. So I found, but anyway, that was the first part of the Emma Goldman Papers. In the beginning, we had funding from many different federal agencies, which was always very funny to them. They used to say, one person at the NHPRC used to say, oh, Emma Goldman's an anarchist? We thought she was an archivist. Anyway, so that was one part. And I just have to say that there have been hundreds of people who I've worked with. So I'd never feel right taking all the credit for this. And we've done lots of public things. We have 3 high school curricula and a traveling exhibition. The problem we face now is just this horrible funding crunch. I really always feel that, you know, the Mark Twain saying, the news of my death was greatly exaggerated. Well, the news of the Emma Goldman Papers' death is greatly exaggerated because we keep fighting. Like, only today I found out that we have another month that we raised another, you know, almost $20,000. That's what we have to raise, $20,000 to $27,000 to pay for everything. Because the university, although we are honored to have access to the library and work-study students, they truly give us no other direct money.
So this is UC Berkeley, right? They started holding back their funding after a while, right? Isn't the like 2003
yes,
or something?
2003. And that's one of those confluences of things. Can I say that it was because I sent out a mailing? I was getting ready to send out a mailing for our holiday card that included a quote from Emma Goldman from 1915 that I mentioned before, to stand up for war before it happens. And it was censored by
to stand up against war.
Against war. Did I really say that? Oh, my God. And the vice chancellor at that time, the assistant vice chancellor for research, who was not a friend, censored us and said that we couldn't send that out because it was too, it sounded too much like it was against the war in Iraq. And I think a lot of people don't remember how tense that time was. And remarkably, not long after that, well, the New York Times picked up the story. So then the university was shamed by saying, oh, Free Speech University is afraid of a person who died long ago. Eventually had to turn it around. But, you know, after that, we never got funding. Now, it is totally true that the university struggles to get enough funds for so many things. So in a way, you can understand that we're not the highest on their list. On the other hand, there is the lovely project, the Mark Twain Papers. You know, you can make different choices about such things. And, you know, and I sometimes, we try to do kind of creative ways to fundraise. You know, most, I have a vision, like there are about 600 people who always give us about $100, $25, a couple of them give more. I always have this fantasy that if I could get them together in one room, they would love each other because they're all from different walks of life, different ethnic backgrounds, different class backgrounds. But something about Emma Goldman sparks their interest and generosity.
So how can listeners to this program contribute or help support the Emma Goldman Papers Project?
One thing that the university does do for us is allow us to have a conduit through them. So you can literally go to the Give to Cal site and put in Emma Goldman Papers and contribute.
I assume this is berkeley.edu?
Yeah.
Okay.
Kind of. Give to Cal at berkeley.edu.
Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can go to our website also. But we are, our office is off campus, even though we're a campus project. So we also have to pay our own rent. But it's 2241 Channing. And that's another place that you can send a check to. And everything is tax deductible.
Yeah, and we'll put a link to the website of the Emma Goldman Papers Project on our website, againstthegrain.org. Candace Falk is, again, the editor and founding director of the Emma Goldman Papers Project, and volume 4 of the series, the magisterial series called Emma Goldman, A Documentary History of the American Years, is forthcoming. It will be entitled Democracy Disarmed, 1917 to 1919. But again, you can have a look at the 3 volumes that have already come out. Volume 1, Made for America, 1890 to 1901. Volume 2, Making Speech Free, 1902 to 1909. And Volume 3, Light and Shadows, 1910 to 1916. Again, Candace is also author of Love, Anarchy, and Emma Goldman, a Biography, which will be reissued by Rutgers University Press. Candace, best wishes with your fundraising efforts. And thanks so much for joining us to talk about this amazing woman.
Thank you very much. Your show is quite amazing because it's so thoughtful. And I'd like to end by reading 2 quotes to you, one from the government and one from Emma Goldman. Here, the Department of Justice said on August 24th, 1917, Charles Daniel Frey, "She is doing tremendous damage. She is womanly, a remarkable orator, tremendously sincere, and carries conviction. If she is allowed to continue here, she cannot help but have great influence." And just to link that to J. Edgar Hoover's saying that she and Berkman were beyond a doubt the most dangerous anarchists in this country, and if permitted to return to the community, will result in undue harm. And here's something that she said about the patriotism of an immigrant. "May there not be different kinds of patriotism as there are different kinds of liberty. I, for one, cannot believe that love of one's country must needs consist in blindness to its social faults, in deafness to its social discords, in inarticulation of its social wrongs. Neither can I believe that the mere accident of birth in a certain country or a mere scrap of a citizen's paper constitutes the love of country."
Thanks so much, Candace. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.